Amos. The book of Amos is the third in the list or category of the so-called minor prophets. Comes near the Old Testament, of course, after books such as Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel. And tonight we're going to begin a short look at, overview of, the book of Daniel. I don't know how often you've looked at this book or studied it, but you may have noticed in the bulletin this morning that I said that the book of Amos is perhaps the, as some have said, the angriest book in the Old Testament, or maybe in the Bible. It certainly is, as a whole, one of the angriest books of God. And lest you think that that's somewhat blasphemous to say that, I think once you read through the book, and you may well be familiar with it, you see that God is indeed filled with wrath. This is not a book, not a prophet like, or prophecy, you might say, like so many others, that while it might contain a lot of passages that speak of wrath, there is also a lot of hope. There's not a lot of that in the book of Amos. I thought it would be an interesting book for us to look at. I've been trying to, every few months, and you probably noticed this, to go to one of the minor prophets, or one of the prophets. Most of them, I think, have been in that category. We looked at Joel, for example, Zechariah. But I've been trying to select one of them and just kind of do an overview of it. We spend anywhere from 3 to maybe 5 lessons, depending on the length of the book. We'll spend 3 on the book of Amos, so it's not going to be that long a study, but we'll do that throughout the Sunday evenings of October, at least over the next 3 weeks. Now, things kind of come to a head right in the middle of the book. Next Sunday night's lesson, we'll look at that. We'll kind of preface it tonight. We'll look at it coming to a head or to an apex, a climax in the book. And then we'll look at the last few chapters and we'll see how God sort of wraps it all up, what the situation will be. But first tonight we're going to look at the first 3 chapters. And if you're open to it and looking at it, you notice that almost immediately God begins to address the nations, these various nations of the Middle East. If you're looking at the book of Amos and talking about it in its historical setting, and I think you want to do that in this case, especially with this book, you are you're talking about the century, basically, or in the time during the century that follows the division of the kingdom. We know that in about 931 B.C., Solomon died, his son Rehoboam took the throne, was not that wise in his ruling, and very quickly, 10 northern tribes, rebelled against Rehoboam and the 2 southern tribes of Judah and Benjamin. And from that point on, as long as Israel is in existence, down to 722 B.C., so roughly 210 years or so, they remained divided from the south. They remained in rebellion to the king of the south, the king that who was the rightful descendant of David, and thus they remained in rebellion to God. Now, interestingly enough, Amos is written to them during probably the time of their greatest success, and that's why it becomes a very interesting book. I think that people have in their minds, and bear with me for a moment, because I believe it's important to understand the book of Amos by understanding this. People have in their minds, when things go wrong, especially if they are religious people, to immediately look around them and say, oh, God must be mad at me because this is going wrong in my life. Or God must not be blessing me right now. He must not be pleased with me because this is happening and that's happening. And therefore, you know, I'm suffering at the hands of God. Now, that might be right. And if you know there are things that are not right in your life, then that becomes a good time for you to revisit those things and say, you know what, I've been in rebellion to God, I shouldn't be doing these things, and I need to listen to God. Perhaps He is talking to you by what's happening. But it's not always the case. By the same token, when things are going very well, that is, you're prospering, or you're successful, or your life is going good, you know, the things are kind of all falling into place, people tend to feel like, well, God is blessing me, and if He's blessing me, if He's not happy with me,
I must not be, you know, things must not be too bad. I must not be too bad, or else God would be dumping all of these things on me. And so there seems to be the kind of encouragement to our, you know, we sort of give ourselves the encouragement to go ahead living like we're living when things are good, and maybe to question what's wrong when things are bad. And the truth is, things can be going really well, and I want you to listen carefully to this, and you can feel free to talk to me about it, but things can be going really well in your life when your life is really good. I mean, you're really right with God, and God is blessing you. Or they can be going really well in your life right before God is going to bring judgment upon you. By the same token, things can be going really bad in your life as we view it, as we look at it, because God is chastising you. Or they can be going really, really bad in your life because of the circumstances of life, the coincidences of life, or even because you're being persecuted for doing what's right. So it's not enough just to simply look at the circumstances of life and say, are things going well or are they not going so well, and thereby conclude you're either right or wrong with God. That's not enough. It's not enough information. When you look at the book of Amos, there are a number of things that jump out of this book that challenge the traditional thinking of human beings. And that's one of them, and we're going to mention some others as well. Now, I said all of that to say this. When you look at the time that Amos is written in, open the book with me in chapter 1 and verse 1. The words of Amos, who was among the herdsmen of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, or Jeroboam II, son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. Now, it gives you a very specific time. When we look at this time to which Amos, or in which Amos has addressed this book, we talk about a period when Israel has enjoyed and is enjoying, when, and especially the word has enjoyed, some of their greatest, maybe their greatest, military and economic success. And as prosperous as they are also very lifted up in pride about that. And they look at themselves, and the book describes that. They look at themselves as, you know, almost invincible. Certainly, if they can enjoy this kind of thing, they deserve it. And nothing could happen to take it away. And nothing could be further from the truth. If you go to the old, and I'm not going to take time to do that, because I know a number of you have studied it not too long ago, but and will study it in the near future. But if you go back and look at the books of history, like 1 Kings, for example, look at the reigns of Omri and Ahab, and look at their military conquest, and you look at their prosperity. We can study it from the Bible, we can study it from prophecy, we see it in Amos, and we can also study it even from secular history, because there have been a number of artifacts that have been taken from that time. So when you look at all of that, you look at a northern kingdom that's had a great amount of success, and that might be challenging to our thinking, because a great amount of success, even though you have such horrible kings as King Ahab or queens as Jezebel, and they're in outright rebellion against God. So how does that figure? In fact, if you were to look at this time, you would see some kings of Judah who are the rightful descendants of David, and the southern kingdom certainly is the rightful kingdom of God, and they're suffering at times that Israel, in rebellion to God, is prospering. And so God addresses all of that. The book is certainly not indicative of the, you know, of a position of favor. God does not favor these people, and He does not intend to allow them to keep just going on or continuing in their rebellion as they have been. At the very height of their prosperity, God proclaims their doom. Sometimes I think this would be much like if in America, and I you know, I guess there'd be different periods of history we could suggest, but let me just suggest hypothetically. Let's suppose that we just have been to war and won it. And I mean the kind of victory that we enjoyed at the end of World War II, or some of you can remember back in the 80s when Gorbachev and, you know, so, and company had to watch the wall come down. Maybe we've had that kind of victory, we've seen that. Or maybe you might look at other periods of great victory. Some of you might look at times such as civil rights passing or those kinds of things. On the other hand, let's think of times of economic prosperity. Some of you are old enough to remember the great prosperity that hit in the 50s and very early 60s. Or if you want to bring that closer to, you know, to home, we, in the last couple of decades, there have been times when we've had great prosperity. Some of you remember the 80s and 90s. There was almost runaway prosperity. And, you know, if you listen to some of the debates in the elections, it's all about returning to that time, getting back to that. Let's suppose that we've just had a great victory in war, though. And we've had maybe, you know, everybody's invested in the stock market, you know. They're not now, but at one time, you know, a huge percentage of people were, and the market's just running away. That kind of thing. It would be like God coming during that time when everything is going great and saying, "You people are coming down." Who would believe it? You'd look around you and you would see all this prosperity. You see everything just wonderful, and God is saying, "You're coming down. I don't favor you." And you say, "How can you say you don't favor us? Look at all of this. When you don't favor people, God, you bring famines into the land. You bring sicknesses into the land. You bring enemies against us. And we just defeated the Moabites, for example. Our enemies have been defeated. So how is it that you can say to us, as was just read for us a few minutes ago, how can you say that we're about to fall?" Who would believe it? And yet that's exactly what God says. You know, in one of the great catalogs of the nations, and there are some of them in the Bible, several of them really, but this is one that stands out to many people. God just starts addressing all the nations of the Middle East. We had a portion of that read for us. Let's just kind of scan, and I'm not going to really spend a great amount of time looking at the history. I will mention some things about each of these nations, but not much. Because I think there's a greater point in these chapters than that. I think if you notice, as opposed to maybe some lengthy passages in Isaiah, God doesn't spend a lot of time here talking about it. So I'm not going to either. But we will take the point that God makes. I mean, just scan through it and notice. He starts with Damascus. That would be Syria. If you're looking on a map, immediately to the north of Israel. And they've come through a time, you can think in terms of, for example, King Ahab and his entering into the league with Jehoshaphat. Remember that? And they're going up to Ramoth-Gilead. They're going to do battle against the Syrians and all of that. They've come through a time where they've had continual wars with Syria. And many times Syria has been victorious. But if you look at what God says here to this ancient city of Damascus, maybe fitting he starts with it, for as far as we know, it's the oldest city, and it is still the oldest city that in existence in all the world. No one knows of anything older. So thus says the Lord, "For three transgressions of Damascus," yes, for four, "I will not turn away the punishment thereof." And notice how he begins that. "I won't turn away the punishment thereof, because they threshed Gilead with the threshing instruments of iron. And I will send a fire on the house of Hazael, which shall devour the palaces of Ben-Hadad." Now Ben-Hadad, probably, if you're familiar with those stories, that kind of jumps out at you. Ben-Hadad, and Ben-Hadad, the rightful successor to Hazael and so forth. Syria had a dynasty in its own right here. And they were very victorious in their own right. Now again, I'm not going to get off into their wars and so forth. The Bible talks about their skirmishes or wars with Israel, but they had greater wars. And they were successful, very successful. And yet God is going to punish them for what they did to Gilead. God is going to send fire against them. Notice that. And God is going to have a number of them carried away in captivity. If you notice here, "I will break also," and I'm reading verse 5, "I will break also the bar of Damascus and cut off the inhabitant from the plain of Aven, of him that holds the scepter from the house of Aden." Probably not Eden, but if you got that translation, but Aden. "And the people of Syria shall go into captivity," notice, "unto Kir, saith the Lord." In fact, Cyprus, if you want to go back and read and study this history, They did war with Cyprus and didn't come out too well. So when you look at this, what is God saying? And as you go down through, and again, I'm not going to read all of this, but as you scan this, notice in verses 6 through 8, he deals with Gaza. Who is Gaza? Well, one of the five principal cities of the Philistines. Some of you, we watched Samson Friday night, and we were watching, you know, the Philistines. Well, they had five cities, principal cities, a confederacy of city-states, Gaza, Ekron, Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Gath. And he addresses Gaza here. Now, Gaza's probably a familiar name to you, the Gaza Strip and all of that today. And when you think in terms of the Palestinians today, you know, those are remnants or descendants, some people would argue with me on that, but of the Philistines. But if you look at what he says here, basically, these cities are going to be judged by God. And they were. Philistia had prospered for a long, long time. When we see the people in the early chapters or the early books of the Bible, we see them as perpetual enemies of God. I mean, you just kind of go down through their history and they seem to always be fighting the Philistines. Well, what happened to them? You know, what happened is, beginning with Assyria, when Tiglath-Pileser, or Pul in the Bible, came against Israel, the northern kingdom, he came against Philistia. And he almost virtually wiped them out. And you never see them like they were before 722, or literally, I think that took place, I want to say 732. You can check that, but don't take it with a grain. Take it with a grain of salt. But I think it's 732 when they had a great battle with the Assyrians. But here's the point: it left them almost no one. In fact, their culture virtually disappeared. They had a great culture, their own language, and so forth, just disappeared. As time goes over the next several centuries, they were just kind of swallowed up by different peoples. Eventually, the Arabs move in and they become part of the nation of Islam. And then, of course, today they are a Muslim nation and we call them the Palestinians. God wiped them out. Edom and Ammon and Moab are all addressed next, if you notice. For three transgressions of Edom or Ammon or Moab, yea, for four. Who are these people? Well, the Edomites were descendants of Esau. And if you look at the book of Obadiah, that's when God comes in a successive book and spends a lot of time, well, maybe a chapter, but he spends a number of verses there saying Edom is coming down. It's going to be destroyed. But here were some descendants of the brother of Israel. And rather than, you know, an ally to his brother, Edom was always someone who was right there to be against him, to fight against him, even to join with his enemies to try to destroy him. And God is going to bring Edom down. And then you look at Ammon and Moab, those two nations who descended from the incestuous relationship between Lot and his two daughters. And, Ammon is spoken of here. Also, just like Edom, should have been cousins, so to speak, to the Israelites, but always joining with others. And then Moab. And as he addresses Moab here, yes, Israel would have looked, had they gotten this book from Amos, they would have looked at this message and said, how can you say Moab is going, we just beat Moab. And, who is it? Was it King Misha or whatever? We just beat them. And we were victorious against them. And we marched back to Israel in triumph. And God says, yes, and I'm going to turn on Moab. It's not going to be at your hands. They are going to come back. They're going to rise back from that defeat. And they're going to be a people again that has some prosperity, etc. But I am going to come against them and I'm going to utterly destroy them. But you know, then I'm turning to you. Moab was a very strange enemy of Israel. Because if you look at the history, Moab was a constant thorn in the side of Israel. And yet Moab was also a nation that Israel would never leave alone. Judah either, for that matter. They were some of the filthiest people on the face of the earth. They were some of the most idolatrous people on the face of the earth. They had wonderful idols, like, you know, idols that you sacrifice your children to. You literally burn them alive in sacrifice to these false gods. They were a horrible people. And God addresses them, you know, Ruth being a wonderful exception to her people, but God addresses them and says, you're going to be destroyed. Now go to chapter 2 with me, if you will. And continue reading there. As soon as he leaves off Moab, then he turns to Judah. Now this is interesting, because I challenge you to go and find another book, prophet or whatever, that addresses Judah but does it in this short amount of verses. This is not a book about Judah. Judah is mentioned for three transgressions of Judah, yea, for four, just as we had read for us. They are a lying people. They are people who love lies. There are people who despise the commandments of God. They disrespect them. And that's going to cause them to fall. But then God leaves off Judah and turns to Israel. And this becomes the focal point of the book. Go back to chapter 1 and verse 1 again and notice this is a prophecy concerning Israel. But I want you to bear down and look at this with me as God begins to delineate what's wrong with Israel. Now again, they would see themselves as victors, as rich, prosperous, etc. This is how God sees them. Begin reading in chapter 2 and verse 6. For three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they sold the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes. They pan after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor, and they turn aside the way of the meek. They turn them aside. In other words, they lead them astray, we would say. They take faithful people and cause them to be unfaithful. And a man and his father, just like was read, a man and his father go into the same young woman. I mean, how despicable is that? It's bad enough when you're fornicating. That's bad enough when you're committing adultery. That's bad enough. But for a father and his son to go into the same woman, that's just despicable. It's the kind of thing perhaps that Jesus would say, you know, the Gentiles don't even do that. Well, yeah, some of them do. And you can look at when Jesus would say that kind of thing. But what he means is that most people in the world understand that kind of thing is wrong. Fathers and sons, fathers are supposed to be teaching sons how to do right. It's supposed to be like the message of Proverbs, teaching them to come out of that kind of behavior, not going in with them to the same woman. It's despicable. Or like a man having his own father's wife or his consort or whatever. And so God addresses that. A man and his son go into the same woman. And he goes on with this. We see the kind of thing. They lay there, you know, this idea of going in and just basically partying. And perhaps even, as some have suggested the picture here of laying down upon clothes laid to pledge. Maybe that is, you know, taking away even the very garments of unfortunate individuals in taxes or that kind of thing. And then having the gall to take that inside God's house or inside the temple or something like that, or into an area dedicated to God from the past. You know, there were a number of those in the northern kingdom. The temple was in Jerusalem. But there were a number of those Bethel and those type places in the north. And perhaps just lying down beside the altar. Some have suggested, no, this is a picture of fornication here. And the partying and everything that went on. Because as you read the verse here, they lay down on these clothes, but they drink wine of the condemned in the house of their God and all. No respect. And that's what I take away from it. There's just no respect. No respect of what's holy. No respect of anything like that. No fear. When I see people mocking and making fun of a worship service, if I stand up here in the pulpit and I notice during a sermon, it has nothing to do with me. But I think in terms, for example, of Nehemiah 8, when the word of God was read, it's not the reader, it's the word that's being read, and how the people stood up and gave attention. And when it was read, they bowed their face to the ground in respect of God, and they said amen. And sometimes you can look out over an audience, and you can see two young people necking on a pew. You can see people passing notes or cutting up or laughing. You see people texting away and laughing at what's sent back to them. And, oh, okay, and text some more. That kind of thing going on. No respect. And no regard for the fact that, you know, this is not a temple. This is not a sanctuary in that sense. But it is a building purchased with the Lord's money for the specific purpose of coming to worship. This is not a place to come and, you know, Party with your friends while other people are worshiping God. But that's the kind of lack of respect that went on in Israel. They just didn't respect anything. They didn't have dignity. They didn't have self-respect. You know, the idea of going in with your own father or your own son to someone. They had no respect for anything holy or religious or anything sanctified. And so God, as he continues this, and let me drop down a couple more verses and just as he continues to talk about it. I raised up, verse 11, I raised your sons for prophets, your young men for Nazarites. But you, verse 12, you gave the Nazarites wine to drink. Notice, here were innocent people dedicated to God, and others come along. It's as much as saying, here, drink this. Let me get you off this religious track you're on and get you over here with the rest of us. And commanded the prophets, saying, don't prophesy. You know that what that's saying? That's like people, when you try to caution them, or you try to encourage them, or you try to say to them, you need to listen to what God's saying. This is someone looking back at you and saying, I don't want to hear it. It's not, I disagree with it. It's not, let me find another passage and we'll debate it. It's, I just don't want to hear it. People, he says, verse 13, behold, I am pressed under you as a cart that's pressed full of sheaves. When you're emotionally distraught, it's like a great weight on you. Now notice, this is not Amos. This is God. God is emotionally distraught over his people because they are so bad. God reminds them, if you look at this passage, if you'll go back up to the verses I skipped, God reminds them that he's been very forbearing. He's put up with a lot. Go back up, if you will, when he says in verse 9, I destroyed the Amorite before them, whose height was like to the height of the cedars. You remember the spies going in? We can't beat those dudes. You know, they're giants, and they're numerous. We just can't beat them. And they're like grasshoppers over the land, if you've ever seen that. Man, they can come over the land and just devour it. We can't beat people like that. God said, yes, you can. With my strength, you can. Go march around Jericho. You don't even have to fight. I just give it to you. Go march around Jericho. Do that 7 days. You remember those details. Do that 7 days, and when you do that, it's yours. They did it. It fell to the ground. The strongest city in all the land of the Amorites fell to the ground. God did that. I destroyed the Amorite before them, whose height was like the height of the cedars. And he was strong as the oaks. I destroyed his fruit from above and his roots from beneath. I brought you up from the land of Egypt, and I led you 40 years through the wilderness to possess. Now I want you to look at that carefully. I led you 40 years through the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorite. There's a lot there. There are many lessons there. But I want to grab one in particular. Go back with me to Genesis 15. And as you're turning to Genesis 15, let's think about something. You know, I've heard this lately. And I suppose if, as much as anything, this series of lessons grows out of this comment. Maybe it's because it's election year. Maybe it's because things are just bad. You know, maybe it's because people are disgusted with the world and the shape it's in, morally, etc. I don't know. But I have heard more lately than I have ever heard in my life, and that's not an exaggeration, of people bewildered that God doesn't do something. In fact, some people have begun to be very specific with me about it. Michael, what do you think? I watched this thing the other day, and they said that, you know, such and such type flood or such and such type earthquake or such and such type whatever hasn't happened in X number of years and we're overdue. And you know, that's true. If you watch a lot of these science shows, they'll tell you that. It'll scare you to death, you know, because, I mean, devastating hurricane ought to come to New York, so should a flood, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you just figure, man, you know, we're going to die some way soon. Well, God's in control of all that. But other people are looking at it and saying, why? Why is it? We haven't had a pandemic since 1918. Nearly 100 years. It's been since a lot of people died. Now, you know, these are not sadistic people wanting a lot of people to die. But these are people looking around the world and looking at the shape it's in, looking at the utter disregard for God or anything that's holy. People that are full of disrespect, people who don't care. People who have even been raised religiously to respect God, and they don't care. And people are looking around and saying, why doesn't God do something? And I think the nature of people is to note the pride and arrogance. You know, Peter even, if you want to hold your finger at Genesis 15 and look over at 2 Peter 3, and I'll do this backward of the way I've got it written down, but we're coming right back to Genesis. For people to look around and to note, for example, as in 2 Peter 3, when Peter says, know this, verse 3, that there will come in the last days. Well, we're in the last days. We've been in them since the day of Pentecost. There will come scoffers or mockers, depending on your translation. And they'll walk after their own lust. Now, people will look around and say, boy, we see that, don't we? People that mock everything right, everything religious. If you're not aware of any of those, I wouldn't suggest you watch them. But men such as Bill Maher, people like that, just mock everything. Laugh at it. People walking after their own lust, just consumed with what they want in disregard of everything. How their parents feel, how their friends feel, how their family feels, how God feels. Just go after what you want. And saying this, verse 4, overconfident as these people in the book of Amos, where is the promise of His coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, since our ancestors died, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. Now, I think that's an exaggeration for anyone to say that. But you know, in all fairness, if you're one of those people that have come to me recently and said something like that, I agree with you. I mean, I look around and I see how bad it is. And when I see something like that, it might be even a newscaster, some executive, some CEO of a business. People who ought to know better. People who ought to at least have some modicum of respect. And care not. Trample all over the feelings of other people, the beliefs, the faith of other people. When I see that, I even ask myself, how long, God? It scares me. How long do you let it go on? And then I remember. And you look at Genesis 15. Now this was, just do this quickly. This was a time when Abraham, not having received the son, the descendant that God had promised, decided he would adopt Eliezer and appoint him as his heir. Now, that's logical, you know. If I'm not having a kid of my own, I'll appoint an heir and fulfill God's promise. God takes him out, shows him stars of the heaven, says, you see all of that? Your descendants. Okay. But then God, in verses 7 and following, has him go through this ritual where, verse 9, he takes a heifer of 3 years old and so forth, these sacrifices. And the bottom line to all of this, if you will, drop down to verse 12. When the sun was going down, Abram at this time, went into a deep sleep. And lo, a horror of great darkness fell upon him. And God said to him, Abram, know of a surety that your seed will be a stranger in a land that is not theirs. What was he saying to Abraham? I brought you from Ur of the Chaldees, and I told you that you were going to have a son, and I said you were going to have this land, but you ain't going to get it in your lifetime. And in fact, neither is your son. And we know that neither is your grandson, and for that matter, neither is your great-grandson. And so on and so on. In fact, it's going to go down through, notice as God says, your seed is going to be a stranger in a land that's not theirs. And in fact, they will even serve them. You're going to go to Egypt, and you're going to serve and be afflicted for 400 years. We know that that's a prophecy of the slavery in Egypt. Still don't have the land. And also that nation, verse 14, whom they shall serve will I judge, Egypt. And afterward, they will come out with great substance. Now, this is what God is saying in Amos. They'll come out with great substance, great prosperity. People might have looked around in slavery and might have said, we've been here for 400 years. God is never going to keep His promise.
Oh, yes, He is. Yes, He is.
You see, the way man thinks, he looks around and in his mind, in my mind, 100 years is a long time for no big disease to break out and kill a lot of people. You go back in history, you'll see that. I look and in my mind, whatever number of years is a long time, but more importantly than all of that, in my mind, when millions upon millions of unborn children are being murdered every single year, when homosexuals are screaming for rights that God never gave them and people are clamoring to give them to them. And on it goes. I'm not going to turn this into a political speech, but on it goes. And in my mind, I look around and I see people disrespecting God and disrespecting righteous people, mocking them, wanting to take even their rights to worship away from them. How long, God? And there's an answer. And He gave it to Abraham. Listen to it. You will die, verse 15. And you'll die in peace. And you will be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation, they will come here again. For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Now you compare that to what he says in Amos. I fought the Amorites. I destroyed the Amorites. Look at it again in Amos chapter 2. I defeated the Amorites and I brought my people into the land to inhabit it. I brought it into a land of giants. I took it away from those giants who perhaps were like you are, Israel, overconfident, believing you could never be defeated, never be destroyed. I destroyed them. Why? Because their iniquity was full. But what does that say? It says back to God's people, just because I don't act as quickly as you would act. I might look at my nation, but I'd rather look at my personal life. Has there been periods of time in my life when I've sinned horribly and gotten away with it, quote unquote? Nobody caught me. Nobody found out. I didn't go to jail, whatever it might be. And I just went on and on, growing and gaining in confidence. Yeah. There has been. Why didn't God do something? Probably many people ask that. Or would ask that. Why didn't God let you be caught? Why didn't God have you put in jail? Why didn't that happen? Because my iniquity wasn't full. And God is very forbearing. And at any time, should a nation or an individual in that time of God's forbearance turn and repent, God will forgive and bless them. Now, that's not me. That's the Bible. God will forgive and let them start all over. That's the love, the mercy of God, and thank Him for that. But when it reaches a point, we don't know that timetable. God happened to give it to us in Genesis 15, but had He not given it to Abraham, could Abraham ever have figured it out? No. And now God comes to His people and He says to His people, I'm coming in judgment against you. Because you know what? I brought you into this land. And listen to it. At the time He says this, He would have said, I brought you into this land 600 years ago. And what have you done? You've sinned. You've gotten filthier every day. And this is where you are. Your iniquity is full and you're going down. And it doesn't matter how prosperous or successful you look, you're going down. And that's the judgment of God. In chapter 3, and I'm going to introduce this and pick back up with it. God speaks of fellowship with Him. Very strange chapter almost, especially when you read chapter 4. but we're going to look at them. But he speaks of fellowship. And he points out a couple of things. Let's run through them. That's all I really want to do tonight. But let's run through them. First of all, in verse 3, he makes a point to his people. Can two walk together except they be agreed? You know, we're God's people. And that means we are a covenant people. We enter into a covenant with God. We happen to obey the New Testament, our covenant. And that's our covenant with Him. But you know what we say when we come up and we're baptized like we saw this morning? What are we saying? We're saying we agree to what God says. And we enter His covenant. Now then if we proceed to just break it and dishonor it, then God will judge us for that. The basis of fellowship with God is not God is just all merciful, like so many want to believe, and I can do whatever I want to do, and God will say, that's okay. Because we're in a covenant, an agreement. Can two walk together except they be agreed? Sin separates, it divides. Notice how God goes on here to single out the animals and says, will a lion roar, verse 4, in a forest that has no prey? Or will a lion roar and people not listen? If you were out in the jungle in the middle of the night and you heard the roar of a lion, would you stop? Would you look around? Would you try to find some cover? Or would you just mindlessly go ahead and continue to walk through the jungle and wait for the lion to get you? If you listen to the lion, God is saying, why won't you listen to me? I am a lion, and I'm roaring, and you're not listening. And you never have. Notice, if you drop down a few verses, look at verse 9. Published in the palaces of Ashdod and the palaces of Egypt, two of the longest, most perpetual enemies of the Jews, Philistines, the Egyptians. And tell them this. This is what God has to say to you. Now, here would be God's prophet going to God's enemies or His people's enemies and saying, assemble yourselves upon the mountains of Samaria, and behold the great tumults in the midst thereof, and the oppressed in the midst thereof. For notice verse 10, for they know not to do right. You know what God is saying here? He said, go to Israel's two worst enemies, two oldest, longest enemies, and tell them, go get them. Why? Because they don't know to do right. Now you might say, well, that's terrible. If they don't know any better, he ain't saying that. You know, it's like James 4 and verse 17. When you know to the man that knows to do right, do it. That's the point. And what God is saying here in this passage is they don't know. They should. I sent them prophet after prophet. He's made that point. I sent them prophet after prophet. I told them what they needed to do. I told them what they had to do. I finally got to the point that I even had one of my own prophets, Hosea, go out and marry a prostitute to show them how despicable the relationship they're trying to have with me is. And they still won't listen. So just go to their enemies and tell them, come get them. I'm done with them. And lastly, God makes the point in verses 13 through 15. They're idolatrous. They've served other gods. They've been with other gods. They've loved other gods. Perpetually they've done that. And I won't accept idolatry. Never have been willing to. First commandment I gave to Moses. No other gods before me. I won't have it. Now this is a book where God is angry. This is not a book of I'm ready to forgive and all of that. God is angry. And I want you to understand, this is the nature of God. We may not realize it. We may look at the death of Jesus on the cross and not realize that God is a God of wrath as well as mercy. This is God's nature. He's angry. If you're here tonight and you're not a child of God, but you believe in God, you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and you believe that for all the wrath that God can and will summon against people such as this, He would much, much rather forgive. If you will come to the Lord, confess your belief in Him, be willing to repent, and be baptized for forgiveness of your sins, God will certainly forgive you. Maybe you're here tonight, you're a child of God. Like we were talking about a moment ago, you're like these children of God. You might say, I'm not that bad. Okay. But there's sin in your life and you know it. You know what it is that you need to do right. God would say, do it. If you need to come and ask for the prayers of the people here, we certainly would be more than willing to pray with you. Please come. Always stand and sing.